Welcome to Hour 2 of the Jason Rand Show. Josh Hammer filling in for Jason. Jason is out because of his exciting new book launch. That book, again, is What's Killing America? Inside the Radical Left's Tragic Destruction of Our Cities. Go ahead and check it out wherever books are sold. You can check out my own show, The Josh Hammer Show, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm with you tonight as well as tomorrow night. And let's find out now what's trending.
What's trending at the border?
Well, this is not exactly a new topic, but it bears reemphasizing because it's only getting worse. The situation that is currently at the southern border, I mean, these numbers are just, at this point, simply mind-numbing. And these images and these videos that come across our feed every day, I mean, literally earlier today I was watching the TV and I saw what was going on in Eagle Pass, Texas. I mean, we have news crews whose cameras are literally shined. They are pointed at illegal aliens crossing the Rio Grande, ducking under barbed wire in Del Rio, Eagle Pass, all the normal parts there on the Texas-Mexico border. And nothing is happening. There is nothing happening. The numbers so far, there have been at least 2.2 million migrant encounters over the course of this fiscal year. That fiscal year ends at the end of this month. In August, migrant encounters in total, and really when the media says migrant, they mean illegal alien, okay? Do you know what you call a migrant who comes here legally? An immigrant. So when they're using the word migrant, you already know the game is kind of up. It's very much kind of a euphemism. So illegal alien encounters at the southern border in August were well above 200,000. They took a brief nosedive earlier in the summer, but for August just last month, that number was 232,972, according to CBP, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. That is up a good amount, up well over 10% from the 204,000 figure in August 2022. It is the highest number of monthly encounters seen this year, which it should be emphasized, that is pretty rare. Traditionally, illegal alien crossings, encounters in general at the southern border actually go down over the course of the summer for the very simple reason that it is sweltering there in Mexico, where the cartels are operating, and that you typically see less activity there on the border. Let's go ahead and listen to what Fox News' Griff Jenkins reported. He was talking about just what was happening there over the past 24 hours.
And just moments ago, CBP sources confirming to Fox News that in the last 24 hours, another 11,000 total migrant encounters across the entire southwest border. Here, they just keep coming. We want to show you our cameras here. We've got a group in the water now crossing. They're going to be making their way from this small island over, and then they'll try and go through that razor wire. You've got our drone shot as well with migrants in the water that have crossed, trying to get through that wire right now to be taken into custody by the National Guard and the border officials here. They've got more than 5,000 in capacity just in Eagle Pass, Texas. And
so Griff Jenkins there basically described for you what I just described. I mean, we might have been looking at the exact same footage. There are people literally streaming across the border, going across the river, getting under barbed wire with cameras directly pointed at them, and they're not being directly pushed back. They are not being directly deported, directly repelled. Instead, they are oftentimes getting these extraordinarily bogus asylum hearings, asylum being one of the most abused aspects of all of United States immigration law. Asylum has a very narrow, asylum and refugee have very technical, narrow definitions under actual U.S. law. The overwhelming majority of the people who are showing up at our border and saying the magic words, asylee or persecution, they are not there for legitimate asylee or refugee reasons. I mean, are some of them there for those reasons? Sure, I'm not going to – I mean, these are staggering numbers. I'm not going to say that have 2.2 million people arriving at the border illegally. I'm not going to say that there's not a single person, obviously, who is there for legitimate asylum and refugee reasons. But the overwhelming majority of the people who are arriving there, who are fleeing countries from the Northern Triangle of Central America, from Haiti, Cuba, Venezuela, you name it. And not just, by the way, Latin America, but there are people showing up at that border from the Middle East. Hezbollah, the Iranian-funded Shiite supremacist jihadist network, it has long been a close ally of many of the leading cartels in northern Mexico. There are many Middle Easterners there. There have even been actually some Russians and Ukrainians who have been trying to get in. We've seen that from the excellent reporting, among others, of Todd Benzman, who was one of the best border reporters in the country. And the overwhelming majority of these people who are not trying to on explicitly evil grounds for terrorist reasons. I mean, that admittedly would be a minority, but it does happen. The vast majority are coming in for the very simple reason that economic circumstances back where they are fleeing are in bad shape, that the economies of their countries are in the toilet. They can't get work and they want to come here for a job or something like that. It really is not any more straightforward, not any less straightforward, I should say, than that. And the situation is so bad that now that Joe Biden has been multiple years into this, he has resumed the Obama-era practice of catch and release, which is how we typically describe the practice of catching an illegal alien at the border and then releasing him into the U.S. interior with a vague promise of then having to show up to court to ultimately get your hearing about asylum. A huge percentage, it might even be an outright majority, a huge percentage of the people who are released on catch and release grounds, of course, don't actually show up to their asylum or refugee hearings. And why would you? I mean, why would you? It legitimately doesn't actually make any sense. I mean, once you've been released into the interior, what exactly is your incentive? What is the worst thing that can possibly happen to you at that point? Well, you'll just be deported. Well, you know, if you actually show up for your asylum and refugee hearing, unless you get a ridiculously incompetent judge and you're there for economic reasons, you're not going to get asylum or refugee status anyway. You get deported either way. So the incentive structure here just doesn't make sense. We don't have any kind of way of tracking these guys. It's not like they're slapping ankle bracelets on all of these migrants who are flooding in here. And as we've finally seen over the past couple of months or so, many blue jurisdictions have actually said enough is enough. You know, Eric Adams in New York City, to his credit, has been at the forefront of this. He has been at the forefront of saying this is absolutely bonkers, that what is happening in New York City with all of the migrants who are flooding in here, taking our resources, taking our housing, that there is no obvious way that this situation is going to resolve itself. You know, Eric Adams basically said that it is an unsolvable problem without any end in sight. And just to kind of give you one concrete example as to what this looks like in practice, let's stay focused on New York City here. I saw an article over at Fox News today. Headline: 95-year-old veteran kicked out of nursing home to make way for migrant housing. A 95-year-old Korean War veteran said he was given less than 2 months' notice to figure out where he was going to live after the nursing home he resided in was sold, you guessed it, to become a facility for illegal aliens. A 95-year-old Korean War veteran doesn't know what he's going to do next. He's being booted from his nursing home because these self-entitled illegal aliens showed up at our doorstep, get shipped to New York City. I mean, everyone involved in this chain of command that leads to headlines like this, to stories like this, deserves to be fired. I mean, this is borderline treasonous behavior for people like Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, who knows exactly what is going on at the southern border and refuses to lift a finger about it. You know, at Newsweek, where I work, we published an op-ed from Congressman Andy Biggs of Arizona, a handful of months ago, earlier this year in 2023, calling to impeach Mayorkas. You know, maybe that would have been a slightly easier place to start than trying to impeach Joe Biden, because Mayorkas has no excuse whatsoever for the utter disgrace and humiliation that is the current state of the United States southern border. I mean, Joe Biden, as we've mentioned already on the show, his approval rating on this issue of immigration is astonishingly low. It is 23%, I think was the number in that ABC News, Washington Post poll that came out this past Sunday. And you know what? Joe Biden's actually even making it worse. He's making it even worse because you know what Joe Biden also did towards the end of last week? He granted over 480,000, almost half a million Venezuelans. I believe they were Venezuelans. He granted them an extension of what in immigration laws referred to as TPS, temporary protected status. TPS is kind of a quirky angle of immigration law that effectively says that if you are here from a country and something goes very, very wrong back in your country, I'm thinking here of like a tsunami, an earthquake, a famine, things like that, then you will temporarily be allowed to extend your visa and you won't or if you're here illegally, you temporarily will not be deported. Joe Biden gave half a million Venezuelans an extension of TPS. Why? Unclear. I guess what they would argue is that Venezuela is a failed state, which it is, although it happens to be a failed state due to the very socialist policies that the far-left members of the Democratic Caucus, the idiots like AOC, Jamal Bowman, Ilhan Omar, all of them are pushing. Unbelievable. I mean, just unbelievable stuff. Now, the U.S. government is set to run out of money this Saturday. This Saturday is the deadline. It is September 30th. Late last night, the U.S. Senate passed by a strong bipartisan majority, a 777-19, I think was the final count, a stopgap measure to continue the government funded past this September 30th deadline. It's dead on arrival in the U.S. House because Kevin McCarthy is facing some stiff opposition from some Freedom Caucus Republicans led by Matt Gaetz here. Now, my sympathies lie with the Freedom Caucus folks here for sure because their substantive objections pertain to multiple things, all of which I'm sympathetic to, including reducing top-level spending, cutting the Ukraine boondoggle, and then additional border security. The problem with what is going on with the current standoff between Kevin McCarthy and his Freedom Caucus skeptics or antagonists. The problem is that the Freedom Caucus folks, the Matt Gaetzes of the world, they've muddled their message. They've muddled their message because they are not focusing on one issue only. Like I said, they're choosing to lump a lot of concerns in here. And again, I'm sympathetic to basically all of it on the merits. But for purposes of trying to win some sort of concession from the speaker, make this the issue. Make the immigration fight the issue. No more border security, no more funding for the government. That is a winning issue. That is a winning issue for House Republicans. That is a winning issue for the American people because the American people emphatically agree with it. And oh, by the way, in case there is a shutdown, the polling is not nearly as catastrophic as many in the GOP establishment would have you believe. It looks like 34% would blame House Republicans for a shutdown. A much higher percentage, 44 to 45% or so, would blame House or Senate Democrats, Congressional Democrats, and Joe Biden combined. So that would be my quick and dirty advice to the House Freedom Caucus. Meanwhile, at the same time that there is a ton of chaos going on at the U.S. southern border, as we just heard there from Fox News' Griff Jenkins in that audio clip, and as I just relayed to you, there is a ton of other chaos going on in America's inner city. So yesterday on the program, we discussed how Target is closing 9 of its stores due to escalating theft and the fact that they don't think that their workers and customers can stay safe. Just today, I think I saw CVS, which accounts for something like 30 to 35% of all prescriptions in the pharmacies in America, announced that it is starting to close many of its stores for similar reasons. Very, very terrifying trends. And, you know, we saw, unfortunately, some tragic footage in the city of Philadelphia late last night, overnight, into the morning hours, as to what exactly it is that Target, CVS, and companies like that are afraid of. So the city of Philadelphia started massively, massively rioting because a police officer, I mean, it's a very familiar story by now, a police officer who was involved in the tragic death of a black American who was killed at a traffic stop. The facts are are fairly straightforward. It looked like he was fleeing from the scene. I mean, people were calling for the cop to be indicted, notwithstanding that there was a fairly direct U.S. Supreme Court case called Tennessee versus Gardner, which probably protected the cop's actions. So anyway, the grand jury does not indict the cop based on my very kind of cursory view of the facts here. It looks like they've made the correct decision. But the city of Philadelphia disagreed with that non-indictment and just starts looting and rioting. Apple Store, they're stealing free iPads. There are people giggling as like they're filming, all the windows being smashed and everything. And, you know, to the police captain's credit, the police captain there in Philadelphia was on TV this morning saying this is like beyond inexcusable. It's sad. We're going to start enforcing or prosecuting whatever. Even the mayor of Philadelphia, who is certainly a liberal, was there saying much of the same things. Here's the problem. The problem is that the district attorney, the DA in Philadelphia, is a guy by the name of Larry Krasner. Well, who is Larry Krasner? Larry Krasner is a paradigmatic Soros-funded prosecutor. He explicitly campaigned on Soros-style quote-unquote criminal justice reform. He explicitly campaigned on reduced incarceration. He explicitly campaigned on ending criminal charges against those caught with marijuana, on ending cash bail. Basically, everything that you can imagine, he campaigned on. And his campaign, because just in case you think I'm making this up, he received a direct $1.45 million contribution when he first ran for DA back in 2017. He garnered an almost $1.5 million contribution from George Soros. Just like Alvin Bragg in New York City, just like Kim Fox in Chicago, just like Kim Gardner in St. Louis, George Gascon in Los Angeles, Larry Krasner is among the worst of the worst. I mean, he is a Soros prosecutor to his core. So good luck. I mean, good luck, Philadelphia, when it comes to actually trying to prosecute what happened here. I hope that they are prosecuted. I hope that each and every one of these thugs who we have direct footage on is looting. I hope that each and every one of them is prosecuted. But how can you have any confidence that is going to happen whatsoever when you have Larry Krasner as your DA? So it's really just unfortunate. And there is, you know, ultimately to kind of tying these two strands together here, looking at what's happening in the southern border and the degradation of our border integrity, our sovereignty, our nation state, and tying that into just the utter anarchy and rote destruction that is happening across big blue cities in America. This is fundamentally tied together by a lack of respect for the rule of law, where the rule of law ceases to mean anything whatsoever. Really, really, really sad, sad stuff. Really just makes the mind reel, frankly, how these people get elected to office in the first place. Recall that it was last summer, it was June 2022, where Chesa Boudin, the iconic Soros-funded nutjob Marxist prosecutor out in San Francisco, was actually recalled. It was actually the Asian Americans, predominantly the Chinese community there in San Francisco, which actually kind of got that campaign started, and kudos to them because it was successful. That model, I mean, not that San Francisco has gotten any better, unfortunately. If anything, it's probably gotten worse. But at a bare minimum, you've got to start by getting these absolute bums out of office. One other headline that came across my feed this morning, I saw Richard Hanania tweet this out, which I just thought was absolutely astounding and has to do similarly with kind of the Larry Krasner stuff, Black Lives Matter and whatnot. Big article in Bloomberg. Corporate America promised to hire a lot more people of color. It actually did. And the subheadline here is, the year after Black Lives Matter protests, the S&P 100 added more than 300,000 jobs. 94% of the 300,000 jobs the S&P 100 added after the BLM riots went to people of color. So that would be by 2021, because the riots started in the year 2020. I mean, that is astonishing stuff. So the overall job growth included 20,524 white workers, but the other 302,000 went to people of color. Now, last I checked, the left subscribed to something called disparate impact theory, which basically means that you can just look at summary statistics like this and then form subjective conclusions. Like, you can basically conclude that someone was discriminating because of the way the numbers ultimately crank out in the end. This looks to me like overt racial discrimination against white Americans. I mean, how else can you possibly look at that? And again, I'm using here the disparate impact prism, the analytical prism, the lens that the left itself always talks about. So, either you believe in this or you don't. It's not racism only if it disproportionately hurts the traditional victims of racism, blacks, Hispanics, and so forth there. The notion that you can't be racist against white Christians is insane. The left has tried to make it seem like racism against white Christians is impossible because they've tried to redefine the word racism to include some sort of power structure where you got to have systemic power or countervailing power in order for it to be racist. Totally nonsensical. Totally nonsensical. Now, could it be the world's biggest coincidence that 94% of the S&P 100's jobs 1 year after the Black Lives Matter protests, with the proliferation of DEI idiots throughout corporate America, the bureaucracies there? Could it be just the world's greatest coincidence that they all went to underrepresented minorities? Sure. Is it likely? Give me a break. Unbelievable. Anyway, join us for the next KTTH Freedom Series, Saving Washington State, hosted by Jason Rance and Brian Suits at the historic Everett Theater on October 24th. Special guests include former Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best, the Discovery Institute's Jonathan Cho, and Washington GOP Chairman Jim Walsh. Tickets are on sale for $770 plus fees. VIP packages that include a copy of Jason's new book are still available too. Get your tickets at ktth.com.
Tacoma, Bremerton, Bothell.
This is the Big Local on the Jason Rance Show.
Redmond, Sumner, Kent.
Stories about you, not about Seattle.
The Big Local is brought to you by Alpine Specialty Cleaners, online at alpineclean.com. This is the part of the show where we shift the focus from Seattle to the communities where you live. We'll start off in Auburn, where we have an Auburn body shop that is very frustrated after being hit by burglars three times just since early Monday morning. So early Tuesday morning, the thieves stole a Kia to ram their way out of the parking lot at a local body shop there. The Kia is a total loss, and surveillance video shows the crook running over to the Kia in the parking lot and quickly starting it. Let's take a listen to shop manager Tom Walters, who's talking about how the thieves raided the cars that were damaged from previous break-ins.
This morning, just after midnight, they came in. They broke some windows this time.
Windows of the vehicles?
Of vehicles that were here for repair. Got into those, rummaged through those for whatever they try to find.
Right. So obviously any crime is bad, but the key part of this particular story to me is the fact that the shop manager who you just heard from there says this is the third time in just 26 hours that someone had broken into the shop. So again, the first time was overnight, Sunday into Monday. It was at 3 a.m. Monday morning. The target seemed to be vehicles already waiting for repairs. I mean, you probably should start getting better security at a situation like this. I mean, if this is going to happen time and time again, obviously terrible that we are in a world where you have to be thinking across these things. The Auburn police spokesman Colby Crosley, according to the article that I'm seeing here, said so far here in 2023 we've had more than 130 Kias stolen. That's a lot of Kias. I mean, that's out of nearly 1,000 vehicles stolen so far. Not entirely obvious to me why Kia seems to be the most frequently stolen car, or at least one of the most frequently stolen cars there. But again, at some point, three cars being stolen in just over 26 hours or so, I mean, that starts to be a trend. Do you agree with that, Producer Max?
Yeah, and you know, this one just really strikes you. This poor auto shop owner that they talked to on the Cairo 7 story. I mean, three break-ins in, like 24 hours. And yeah, it's these Kias, it's these Hyundais. It seems like we talk about, these cars getting stolen, these cars getting broken into, like, quite literally every single day on this program. And, it's ironic and funny, maybe not in a good way, that a lot of these cars that were getting rummaged through, it sounds like they were damaged from previous break-ins. I mean, what's left in these cars after the first break-in attempt is what I'm curious about. But yeah, it's just another crazy crime story that seems far too commonplace, especially down on the South Sound.
Yeah, way too commonplace. I mean, again, this gets back to what we were just talking about towards the end of our last segment there, which is just this degradation of respect for the rule of law. I mean, look, I'm a lawyer by training. This is one issue that really riles me up more than anything else, is just crime run amok, is this culture of looting and thievery and shoplifting that we see time and time again. And, you know, nothing really drives that home, I think, more than three cars being stolen from one poor shop manager in 26 hours. Really, really bad stuff. Moving on to Lakewood, Washington, a suspect was hallucinating on LSD at the time of a deadly crash, the doctor said. So the suspect here told a responding officer that he was having a, quote, experience on LSD soon after the crash. Toxicology results are pending. As for the man himself, you know, this is a deadly crash. I mean, he's facing two counts of vehicular homicide. I mean, who is the kind of person, first of all, who takes LSD in the year 2023? I mean, at least when I think of LSD, I mean, I'm a total prude when it comes to these things in general. I've never touched anything remotely resembling LSD with a 10,000 foot pole. But I mean, when I think of LSD, I think of like the 1960s. I mean, I thought that was kind of like the 1960s rock band drug of choice. I mean, I think of like the Woodstock Festival in upstate New York, Jimi Hendrix, things like that. So kind of weird to even hear about LSD as opposed to cocaine or fentanyl, which are the narcotics we typically hear more about here in the year 2023. But someone who is just utterly stupid and reckless enough to take LSD and then get behind the wheel of an automobile, I mean, unbelievable. And then the police here, the Lakewood police, said it wasn't just the LSD intoxication, but it was also speed. So the dude was speeding. I mean, that shouldn't be much of a surprise as well here. So overall, it was a couple, and their two children were in one car, and the lone male driver in the other. All five were taken to the area hospital. We have numerous reported deaths. Terrible situation, obviously. Curious for your take on this one, Producer Max.
Yeah, just looking at some more of the details from King 5 here. Approximately 100 miles an hour and ran a red light. This is just obviously a devastating story of just absolute reckless stupidity. But we talked a little bit about setting high bonds yesterday, Josh, on the pursuit story that started in Bellevue yesterday. At least Pierce County judge set bail at this one, $200,000. So this guy, Sean Lakey, who caused this horrible, horrible fatality, unlikely to get out of jail with that super high six-figure bond. So at least one positive spin you can take out of this. This guy, in all likelihood, staying behind bars.
Yeah, I'm happy you pointed that out, Max. I mean, that is a very helpful and insightful silver lining to what is otherwise a tragic story. I mean, hopefully that is a trend that takes off here in Washington State. Hopefully that is a trend of setting higher bail, and not just Washington State, but across the country. I mean, we were talking about Larry Krasner in Philadelphia in our last segment, maybe 10, 15 minutes ago or so. Larry Krasner ran on a bail reform and cash bail platform that is a very, very popular plank for progressive prosecutors these days. So good for the Pierce County prosecuting attorney on Monday for putting a $200,000 bail number for this utter miscreant and deviant who had the absolute recklessness and lack of foresight just to take LSD in the first place and then to just get behind the car. Tragic, tragic stuff. Hopefully he sits in jail and rots there for a very long time. Finally, we go to Spokane, where a new short film is exploring the Spokane homeless crisis. The executive producer of this film is blaming the former city council for that. Shouldn't come as a huge surprise. Let's go ahead and listen to the filmmaker himself. His name is Larry Stone. He says the city has the power to fix its own homelessness problem.
elected officials, many politicians say this is a national problem, it's not our fault. But the reality is we created this problem in Spokane and we can solve it.
And just to drive home that point, Producer Max, I think this is absolutely wild. I mean, I mean, we actually have a clip here from someone who was a homeless woman herself who was featured in this film, who actually says that cities are making it easier to be homeless. It's a homeless woman saying that. Let's go ahead and listen to Wendy, a homeless woman in Spokane.
So how is it like being homeless in Portland?
It's a piece of cake, really. I mean, that's why you probably got so many out here, because they feed you 3 meals a day. You don't have to do shit but stay in your tent or party. Or if you smoke a lot of dope, you can do that.
3 meals a day. They make it really easy for you, is what she is saying. I mean, my God. I mean, rational human beings respond to incentives, people. If you make it that easy to be homeless, if you make it that easy by way of analogy to be an illegal alien, which is what they're doing in big cities all across the country with this southern border crisis as well, people are going to come. It's really not that difficult. You know, I saw something, I think it was a reel on Instagram out of Denver, Colorado. A buddy of mine who lives there sent me this reel of this massive sprawling homelessness encampment in Denver, Colorado. And it looks like the homeless people there had an actual bar, like a full-service bar with, like, top-shelf liquor set up inside of the homeless encampment. I mean, crazy, crazy stuff here. And, you know, the filmmaker here himself, Larry Stone, who's a longtime Spokane resident, this is him talking. He says, quote, "Elected officials, many politicians say this is a national problem. It's not our fault. But the reality is we created this problem in Spokane, and we can solve it." Let's go ahead and listen to our final clip here from Larry Stone, who's pointing out a specific policy decision that he believed caused many of Spokane's homelessness problems.
Our film shows that in 2017, our city council allowed public camping, and that's when our homeless problem just skyrocketed.
Again, there you go. I mean, this is not difficult stuff. I mean, this should be very straightforward. You're going to allow public camping. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think, Producer Max?
Yeah, and, you know, we've seen actually some recent efforts out of Spokane just in the last couple of weeks. They're really trying to take back their downtown core. So I think this film from the short film from Larry Stone is kind of highlighting when the problems were at their worst. But Spokane luckily has a really good mayor in Nadine Woodward, who we hope to have on the show at some point next week to talk about some of this stuff. They're really making a notable effort to take back their downtown, and it's encouraging to see, Josh, at least local leaders and people in the film industry too, whoever, acknowledging these problems. They're not acting like these things are not happening on their city streets. At least over in Spokane, they have a heightened sense of awareness, and it feels like there is at least some work being done to try to solve some of these problems.
Yes, and homelessness is an infamously difficult issue to solve. I'm not sure anyone has kind of a magic bullet that will solve everything, but at a bare minimum, stop incentivizing it. I mean, how much is that just pure common sense, people? My God. Coming up at 4:45, you pick the news. Story number one, New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez's wife totes Chanel purse to New York City court as the couple pleads not guilty to pocketing bribes, $100,000 in gold bars. Or story number two, Rob Schneider unleashes fiery social media response after Canadian Parliament honors a Nazi. Let us know what you want to hear. Text story one or story two to 1-800-465-8770. That's 1-800-465-8770. Your story coming up right after this on The Jason Rance Show.
You pick the topic on The Jason Rance Show.
So you picked the topic, and you have chosen to talk about this utterly comical state of affairs pertaining to the corrupt senator from the state of a very corrupt state, New Jersey. That, of course, would be Bob Menendez. So Bob Menendez has been indicted on federal charges pertaining to bribery. This is not a repeat. This is actually happening again. So Bob Menendez was actually first indicted on allegations of corruption and bribery back in the year 2015. He was ultimately acquitted of those charges, but This time he was just acquitted on Friday on allegations that he and his wife accepted over $600,000 in bribes from a group of businessmen in his state of New Jersey on behalf of interests in Egypt. Not going to lie, if you were to tell me that there was one senator who was potentially going down because of literal gold bars of corruption from a foreign country, I'm not sure that Egypt would have actually been the country that comes first to mind here. I actually was in Egypt myself, primarily in the Cairo area back in January, and I guess a polite way of saying it would be that I am not exactly itching to go back there. In fact, my fiance and I, among the things that we did there, the pyramids were fun and all that. The museum was fun, but among the activities that we had planned was we had this Nile River kind of a cruise would be overstating it, basically a boat to go and get some snacks, maybe a drink or two up and down the Nile River, arguably the most famous river in the world, right? The pollution in Cairo, the air smog was so bad and it was so hard to breathe, especially for my fiance, that we had to cancel the trip. I mean, Cairo in many ways is what the former president Donald Trump would refer to as a something hole. I'm not going to say that here on Family Friendly Radio, but you got the idea. So anyway, all that to say that based on my own personal experience, Egypt is not the first country that would have come to mind based on who would be most likely to bribe a sitting U.S. senator to the tune of over $600,000. But sure enough, the FBI did find $500,000 in cash and more than $100,000 in literal gold bars in a raid of Bob Menendez's home this past year. They have Google searches. They have screenshots of he and his wife texting about this. They have searches of him like literally Googling like how much is a bar of gold of this carat worth. I mean, seems like federal prosecutors have the man dead to rights, frankly. I mean, yes, and in theory, innocent until proven guilty. I mean, that is no doubt true. Innocent until proven guilty for Donald Trump, for Bob Menendez. We're all innocent until proven guilty. That is a fundamental truth of the Anglo-American legal tradition here. But, the evidence here already seems to be pretty overwhelming. And again, this is someone who was previously indicted on scarily similar grounds going back to 2015. And specifically, what we most recently saw from Bob Menendez is that he and his wife were at federal court in New York City. He was there to plead not guilty to pocketing bribes there. And his 56-year-old wife, Nadine, can be seen leaving the courthouse literally holding a Chanel bag. And look, I'm not knocking Chanel. I mean, many women are really into these upscale French fashion houses. I mean, a lot of people like Chanel, but I mean, optics, dude. Optics, if nothing else. You're there because your husband is being indicted for bribery from a foreign government to the tune of $600,000, $500,000 in hard cash, and $100,000 in gold bar, in literal gold, and you're going to show up there carrying a Chanel bag. According to the New York Post, this particular Chanel bag, which sat alongside her during the whole hearing, can fetch as much as $2,300 on some rebag resale sites. I mean, for what it's worth, Bob Menendez himself has denied these allegations. Like I said, though, the evidence here, from what I've seen thus far, seems to be pretty overwhelming. Let's go ahead and listen to Bob Menendez's silence as he left the courthouse in New York City.
Senator, if they give you gold bars, will you resign?
Everybody out of the way.
Bribe
get off
bound.
The street. Get off the street.
So he's not answering questions, is the point of that clip. He is putting his head down and not answering questions. He apparently is addressing his Democratic caucus tomorrow morning. Is he going to announce that he's going to resign? Well, it's possible. A ton of prominent Democrats have already called for him to resign. Nearly half of New Jersey's Democratic lawmakers have already called for him to step down, including Congressman Andy Kim, who has actually already announced that he's going to primary Bob Menendez, try to take him out unless he resigns, in which case it will obviously be an open primary. Many, many, many other prominent Democratic senators have also been calling for Bob Menendez to resign. I saw Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado on Fox News earlier today telling Neil Cavuto that he thinks that it's time for Bob Menendez to get out. Right here in the state of Washington, both Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell have indeed joined the calls. We might even call it a growing chorus of Senate Democrats who are calling for Bob Menendez to resign. Patty Murray called the charges against her colleague from New Jersey, quote, extremely serious, and the details, quote, deeply disturbing. And if he refuses to resign, Patty Murray added, she said, quote, I encourage the Senate Ethics Committee to open an investigation into this separate from the ongoing criminal case. I would predict, if I had to guess, that he's not going to resign. It just doesn't seem like the Bob Menendez thing to do. Many have called for him to resign. I mean, including the governor of his own state, New Jersey, Phil Murphy, including his fellow New Jersey senator, Cory Booker. A lot of people were looking to see what Cory Booker would say. Cory Booker, a one-time close ally Bob Menendez, has come out and said that Bob Menendez should resign there. Now, some Republican senators actually have been somewhat ironically less outspoken than the Democrats. So Tom Cotton, who's one of my favorite senators in the Republican caucus, I don't agree with him on everything, obviously, but I think he's quite good in general. And he's one of the most ardently pro-rule of law, law and order senators. That's part of the reason why I like him so much. He came out actually and said, you know, let it play out, innocent until proven guilty. And I have to pick a bit of a bone with this. I am not objecting to the idea of innocent until proven guilty, obviously. Like I said, that is a fundamental cornerstone of our Anglo-American system of justice. Here's the problem. We're talking here about two separate things. We're talking about two separate things that can get very easily conflated. One of them is the actual criminal prosecution. You are obviously innocent or proven guilty as a matter of the way federal prosecutions work. But what is happening in the U.S. Senate pertaining to the calls for him to step down, that's totally different. And put another way, it doesn't really directly matter what a court of law finds after a criminal trial with respect to his guilt or lack thereof. That doesn't have a direct bearing on the political question, not the legal question, but the political question as to whether he should step down from his role as senator from New Jersey. These are totally separate calculations, and I understand why it's easy to conflate these two things. It's very easy to confuse legal and political judgments in general. I mean, I think back to the Democrats' idiotic second impeachment of Trump, which was over the January 6th riot in 2021. He was basically already out the door. They decided to do this ridiculous baloney impeachment anyway. And at the time, the debate was, you know, does he have to be guilty of an actual black letter statute, a criminal statute, in order to be indicted for breaching of public trust, abuse of power, whatever the exact charges were. And the debate at that time was whether Trump might be guilty of incitement to riot. I mean, you know, if you really want to go there, incitement to insurrection, something crazy like that. And again, these are separate judgments. Trump did not deserve to be impeached either of the two times the Democrats tried that ridiculous charade. I wrote many, many pieces and columns at the time saying that he should not be impeached. But the point stands that those are just totally separate arguments. I mean, what is legal in this context does not necessarily affect what is political, and what is political does not necessarily affect what is legal. I think that Bob Menendez should resign. I think that the evidence at this point is overwhelming. He has totally disgraced himself. Corruption like this is the reason, above all, that the public does not approve of the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. It besmirches the institution. Terrible stuff. We'll be back at the top of the next hour. I'm Josh Hammer, filling in for Jason Rance.